The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on this evening's The Space Show, a few hours ago, the team in charge of the Rosetta spacecraft and the Philae lander gave a briefing. We were listening in, and we were able to give you the very latest on this most exciting exploration of comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko.
2015, the year we get our first detailed look at Pluto. The space show will be there. Join us Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m.
Yes, looking at Pluto, but guess what? We have been looking since last year at another object in the solar system. That's comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko, otherwise known as 67P and nicknamed CG. And we are going to go now to a press conference which was held just a few hours ago at the European Geophysical Union. We have the various presenters telling us the very latest on the Rosetta mission, the mission that is now at the comet. The presenters will introduce themselves.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Okay, I'm Matt Taylor, if you didn't know. I'm the ESA project scientist. I'll give a brief overview, very brief, of where we are at the moment with the mission. If it has escaped your notice, we are now around a comet, around CG67P. We have been since August last year. We have been in orbit, but now we left orbit recently at the end of January. We had gravitationally bound orbits, then we went into these quite extravagant trajectories to do flybys. We had one in Valentine's Day where we reached about 6 kilometres from the surface and were able to image very close to the surface. We have a close flyby at this radius and actually managed to capture the shadow of the orbiter on the surface of the comet. Subsequently, we were doing other manoeuvres to go far away from the comet and then come back in again. And in March, we did another flyby, but had started to, and in the previous flyby, we'd experienced some issues with star trackers. And then for the March flyby, at the end of March, where we were flying over roughly the neck region, we were having some problems with pointing, where the star tracker navigation was getting confused because of the cometary environment. So we had problems with pointing, we had a safe mode, and because it's safe, what the spacecraft does is fly away from where the danger is. This is what would happen in any circumstances. Even if the comet split as well, this would be another thing we'd do. We'd move away, very far away from the comet, and this is what happened. So that's what makes you safe. You get away from where the danger is, which is actually the comet. Now we are undergoing a bunch of pyramid-like orbits to reapproach the comet. This is similar to the trajectories that we had last year, in the second half of last year. We'll alternate these with Terminator orbit as well, so we'll go into the plane of the Terminator to get a feel for how the spacecraft is doing around the comet, because it turns out that it's actually quite difficult to fly spacecraft around a comet. Today, you'll hear about the first results, actually, from the lander, but more importantly for me is that we're seeing combined measurements from both the orbiter and the lander. I think that's fantastic. This is a great achievement of the teams. This is going to give us a fascinating insight into the primordial solar system. We'll also hear a little bit about Philae's journey across 67P following the touchdown on the 12th of November. And also from dear Stefan, we'll have an update from the lander itself. And with that, I will pass over to my esteemed colleagues.
Yeah, my name is Hans-Ulrich Auster. I'm working at the Technical University in Braunschweig, and I'm the PI of the orbiter of the lander magnetometer experiment. And what we did, we tried during the descent phase to measure the magnetization of the comet. First of all, we are the only team probably which is benefiting from this jumping of Philae, because usually we only had the chance for measuring at one place the magnetization. Now, after all these bouncing periods, we are able to measure the magnetization at 4 points and during the trajectory in between. And the first task we had to reconstruct the descent phase and this bouncing trajectory. And that can be done partly by a magnetometer. Of course, we need external information. We knew from the OSIRIS camera in which direction we flown after the first touchdown. We knew from CONCERT where finally the landing site was. But we got a lot of information, additional information from the magnetometer as well. It's like if you have a small compass and if you're turning the compass, then you see that the needle is moving within the compass housing. And something similar like that, we try to reconstruct the motion of the lander. And of course, if you are bouncing to crater rim, as we see in the middle of this figure here, where we had this collision with the crater rim, then you see that this pattern changed dramatically, because if you're touching with one leg the crater rim, then of course the rotation period decreases and we are tumbling, and so you see another periods into the magnetometer signal. And we saw exactly the landing times, because our sensor is mounted on a small boom, and if this boom is touching the ground a little bit, then you have a relative motion between boom and lander, and that generates a signal into the magnetic field data. So we know exactly the landing times, and we at least detected the multiple touchdowns, which was finally presented by Stefan soon after landing. That's not only the advantage that we are touching four points at the surface, we are touching measuring during the descent and during the ascent. So we have some statistical significance that we have to measure the same signature, which if it is caused by the surface magnetization during descent as well as during ascent. And we had the second advantage that we have in the during all the times the orbiter in space, so that all the external field variation, which has been somehow cancelled out, can be measured in parallel by the orbiter. So we have an accuracy for that measurement which never has been achieved before. Most of the variation which was seen is driven by the solar wind interaction with the comet. We can estimate that the field we measured, which causes by the surface, is less than, let's say, 2 nanotesla. That's a very conservative assumption. And finally, we try to model the magnetization, because so that all together allows that we can compare this value with the values we know from meteorites or from lunar material, and we saw that those magnetization is much less. And we know, of course, that our spatial resolution is limited by the distance between our sensor and the surface. Therefore, we can only say something about magnetization for scales of 1 meter or larger. So we can say nothing about millimeter or centimeter scaled particles. But for these larger particles, we can exclude that that magnetic forces have really played a role in the accumulation of the planetary building blocks. That was finally the result, and which of course limits the options for the planetary building. So one of these theories can be, at least for the higher scales, cancelled out.
Speaking just a few hours ago at the European Geophysical Union in Vienna, Austria, we are hearing from four of the leading lights in the Rosetta and Philae mission. Now, in 2014, the Rosetta Plasma Consortium discovered oscillations in the magnetic field in the environment of comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko. The vibrations are in the 40 to 50 millihertz range. And this is a sonification of the Rosetta RPC MAG data compiled by German composer Manuel Snenz for the European Space Agency. This will be referred to in the next talk.
Karl-Heinz Glassmeier, Technical University of Braunschweig, and I'm the PI of the orbiter magnetometer. And as Uli already mentioned, we are in a very lucky situation, not only that we had three surface contacts and have been able to fly over the surface, but also we had the orbiter as a monitor out there in space some 17 kilometers from the surface. And what you see on this figure here is what we call the singing comet. Since August last year, we see a very clear signal in the orbiter magnetometer data. The frequency is about 50 millihertz. And this is a dominant signal in the inner coma of the comet. It's a clearly a signal which is generated by the interaction of the comet, the outgassing comet, with the solar wind. And we are lucky in that this very unique signal is kind of a guide field. And doing measurements also on the surface, we also see this singing comet phenomenon. So it's not only present out there in the plasma, it can also be seen at the surface. So all the signal we see at the surface is dominated by this periodic oscillation. So we have kind of a very nice basis and background signal, and we can say that what we see on the surface is mainly due to this plasma phenomenon. It's not due to some mechanism, to some dynamical feature we see at the surface. For example, you could imagine if we fly over the surface and if we have a spatially varying magnetization, we would expect also a time variation of the magnetic field seen in the lander, but we can exclude that because we have this guide field in the back. And just to demonstrate how clearly correlated these signatures are, you see registrations from both the orbiter and the lander. You see almost no difference. So what's out there in space is also seen at the surface, and this significantly helps us to say that the magnetic field at the surface, as measured by ROMAP, is mainly due to the plasma physical processes seen in the plasma out there. I think without the orbiter data and this unique combination of both magnetometers, we would not have been able to discriminate between spatial and temporal variations. I think there's another aspect which is very helpful, because we know what the signal is out there in space, and because we know that the same signal is seen on the surface, we can use both magnetometer measurements to orient the lander. You know, for the orbiter, we know how the attitude of the orbiter is, but we do not know that for the lander. Is it in this direction or that direction or that direction? Now what we do is, because we know that both are seeing the same signal, we just rotate the lander coordinate system in such a way that the measurements coincide with that of the orbiter, and that gives us an opportunity and a possibility to determine the attitude of the lander. So we know all the way down to the surface and at the surface, by the combination of both magnetometers, we now know the attitude of the lander. That's very important also for later attempts to find the lander and so on. Well, this is a little bit complex, and it's reflecting the complex plasma physical processes generating this singing. What you see here is we have outgassing from the comet, and the outgassing neutrals, they ionized, and these ionized electrons and ions here, they constitute a very strong current in this plasma. The current has a strength of about 100 amperes, and this current is flowing across the solar wind stream and the interplanetary magnetic field, and it's becoming unstable. This is like your garden hose. If you turn on the water, which is the current, you see that the garden hose is also moving around. And a similar thing is happening here. And this is generating this singing, which we are using as a reference signal to interpret also the lander observations. And this signal, as I said, was very important to really confirm that the field we see at the ground, at the surface, is below 2 nanotesla. Just to give you an idea what 2 nanotesla means, in this room we have something like 50,000 nanotesla magnetic field generated by processes within the Earth, and down at the surface of the comet we have something less than 2 nanotesla. So it's a very sensitive measurement we had to make there, and this was only possible by combining the two magnetometers. This is a very important thing I like to know. You can see I'm in cometary physics in Rosetta since 25 years. I started as a young person and have grown up, and I'm most fascinated by all the young people involved in the project and by all the cooperation which is going on. I think Rosetta is not only a nice combination of different instruments, it's also quite remarkable, truly international achievement. It's really fun to cooperate with all the different teams, young people, older people. We are all fascinated, and yeah, we go ahead with all this nice results coming up in the next months. Thanks.
Now, that plasma waves that he was talking about there, the vibrations in the plasma around the comet, yeah, that was the sound with the woodpecker type sound that we played earlier on, and that has spawned dozens and dozens of pieces of music, and we'll try and slip one, and I've made up two compact discs of that music, but first let's remind you who we are.
Reaching into your community. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Now, we're going to return to the European Geophysical Union in Vienna. We recorded this earlier this morning.
So, I'm Stefan Ullermetz from German Aerospace Center, DLR, in Cologne. I'm the project manager of the lander. And, I will give you some news on the status of the lander itself, on the status how we try to find it with observations from the orbiter instruments and cameras, and the status on the attempts for re-establishing contact. As you know, we are all hoping that Philae will wake up again when we are closer to the sun and we can do more science. As mentioned by Uli, we were obviously bouncing after the first touchdown at the comet. What you see right here is the trajectory as it was calculated using various data, images from the orbiter camera where the lander could be seen, also other measurements including the magnetometer, which helped a lot in determining the exact times and positions of these touchdowns. Lander was touching down very accurately at the targeted point, but then it bounced off, had another contact, what you see a bit to the right at this crater rim, which deviated the trajectory, and is now somewhere in the area where this blue curve ends. And I say somewhere, we have quite a good understanding where this is. It's in the range of 30 times 50 meters or so. It's not really a huge area. It's not that we are completely ignorant where the lander is. Of course, we could not identify it clearly on any of the OSIRIS images yet. This is an image you almost certainly have seen, taken by the Shiva camera on board the lander. And this is the surrounding of the lander, or one view, as an astronaut would see it looking out of the lander, the terrain around. You see these various structures, and you also see in the front one of the landing feet of the lander. Now, this is the image from the full panorama, which is best illuminated. The other images clearly show that we are surrounded by walls, and this is also the reason why the lander is in a very dark and poorly illuminated spot right now. This is just to remind you on the effort which is taken right now to find out where the lander is and to recalculate this trajectory. So obviously we have images from OSIRIS, but we were using the CONCERT data, that's the radar instrument which has been used for ranging, and this is also the instrument which was used to give us the exact position, exact in the range of this view. Tens times tens meters where we know the lander is right now. There was other data used, ROMAP, as I said, but also thermal map of MUPOS, the data from ROLIS, the down-looking camera. SESAM is an instrument which had acoustic sensors in the feet, so we could detect the touchdown very accurately and also learn something on the surface properties with this instrument. Now, this is an OSIRIS image And what you see in this red ellipse, this is the range where the lander is expected. And you see there is plenty of little white dots. And just to remind you on the best images we have, after the landing with the correct illumination, they were taken in December from an altitude of about 20 kilometers. The lander would be in the range of 2 times 3 or 3 times 3 pixel. And this exactly is the problem. It's not very distinct. We have to assume that there is some shadowing effect on the lander which camouflages it. And the later the evening, the more wine you drink, the more landers you're able to identify in this terrain. And this is also the reason why so far we do have candidates, but we could not really identify the exact location of the lander yet. Using the magnetometer data, and Uli was saying it's something like a compass, so it's a three-dimensional compass, we do know the attitude of the lander. So this is about the area where the lander is, and you see here a bit symbolic the lander, and this is quite accurately the attitude where it is. So some puzzles we are working on right at the moment. We have images from the descending lander, and we try to combine those images and the area we have, and we see where the first, at least first touchdown was, and try to combine this with measurements with the acoustic sensors with others. And this is not all exactly straightforward right now, so we need some more time to understand what does it mean. Did the feet really hit the rock? Did it hit soft material? This is one of the puzzles we have right there. The other thing you saw on the chart, that we were bouncing not as you would expect perpendicular away, but we were bouncing in a very flat way, which was good for Roma because they somehow could measure the magnetic properties over the surface. But that's not trivial, and it's an indication of some subsurface material, subsurface slope. So also this is something we are working right now to better understand right there. Another thing is you have seen, and it was on the web, the imprints of the touchdown. They do not perfectly fit to the landing gear. Also something we are still working on. Is the lander laying on its side? You've seen the attitude, but since we do not have the high resolution images and the lander not identified, we do not really know how is this relative to the immediate surrounding. These are puzzles. These are things we are currently working, and we still need to do further work to perfectly understand this. Yeah? What is the situation right now? So the lander is resting on the surface. There is no way it would be blown away. Sometimes people ask me whether this is a danger. This is not a danger. It's resting there. It's not anchored, though. We know in principle RF radio frequency communications is possible, but we also know we are in a place which is shadowed, very limited sun illumination. In the time in November, we only had about 1 hour 20 illumination out of the cometary day, and this is also the reason why the lander went into hibernation. So we are sitting somewhere behind a wall or in a hole, and this needs to be better understood. This is a curve from the days around November when we got housekeeping data, and what you see in red, in green, in blue, this is the, in this case, voltage output from the solar panels on the lander, and you see even one panel which was best illuminated, the red one, only had sunlight for about 1 hour and 20, and the other two panels, one the side panel next to it, the other one the lid, they even got illumination for a shorter period, and this is the problem we have. Nevertheless, the comet, like the lander, are getting closer and closer to the sun every day, so the situation improves, and that's why we are hoping that at some point in the next weeks, there will be sufficient power for the lander to wake up again and re-establish contact with the orbiter. There's two basic requirements which need to be fulfilled to wake up. One is a temperature requirement, so the lander may not be too cold. It's somewhere in the range of minus 45 degrees. And we need power to not just boot the computer, but also to re-establish the RF, the radio link with the orbiter. when Philae would boot, because there is both these requirements fulfilled, every 35 minutes it would try to get contact with the orbiter, and since we switch on the orbiter communications unit, so after wake up within about half an hour, so we would be able to reestablish the contact once the lander is woken up. We had a first campaign in March from 12th to 18th when the geometry was good in terms of orbital position above the lander and illumination. We knew this was very, very early still in the year, still a bit too far away from the sun, and unfortunately since we were too far from the sun, no lander signal eventually was received. Now the day before yesterday on the 12th we switched on again the communications unit on the orbiter. At the moment the orbiter is in a listening mode again, so we are hoping to get a signal, but yesterday and today so far we did not hear anything of this. It's difficult to predict exactly the solar input as the season changes on the comet, and it's also difficult to predict the internal temperatures since of course they are very much dependent on the surrounding material. Now, since we know the attitude due to the warm-up measurements, and we know the position of the comet relative to the sun, we also can derive what's the solar path for these 1.5 hours when the sun is shining. And unfortunately, the solar angle, the solar path gets flatter and flatter later. And if we wait later, the sun goes flatter and flatter, which is good from a power point of view because the side panels would be nicely illuminated, but it's not so good from a thermal point of view because the lid where there is thermal absorbers will be less illuminated. This is the prediction of the power we get. The power on the solar panels should be sufficient to boot the lander in the coming weeks. The temperature we have to find out, both requirements have to be fulfilled so the computer can boot. So what's the situation now? As I said, we are at a location with very limited illumination. The situation is improving every day since we are approaching the sun. It's improving until perihelion on 13th of August. We, of course, do not have any danger of overheating. This was an original concern in before we separated. But we are very cold, and this is a problem. So still, the situation is, and I've communicated this before, there is a chance to boot probably in the April-May timeframe. If we also want to communicate, and of course we want to do this, it's May-June, the most realistic dates for wake-up. And then if we get warmer and warmer, we hope that we will even be able to recharge the batteries. The detailed analysis are ongoing and continuing. This will be better once we would be able to identify the exact location on one of the images, because then we see the surrounding additional information as compared to the camera images we have from the lander, but we have to wait a little bit for this. So far, no contact with the lander, but as said, we get closer and closer, and we hope this will change, and I will have better news in a few weeks from now.